This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington, and coming up on Africa News Tonight.
A new UN report describes global food supplies as robust, but famine, drought, and conflict are preventing millions of people from getting enough to eat.
That's VOA's Jody Kapawa reporting. Details next. Also, the World Health Organization is appealing for $10 million as part of an effort to bring drought relief to Somalia. And drought is hurting the animals residing in Eastern Africa's parks and game reserves. We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, a new UN report describes global food supplies as robust, but famine, drought, and conflict are preventing millions of people from getting enough to eat. VOA's Jody Kapawa reports.
The UN Food and Agriculture Organization has released its quarterly crop prospects and food situation report. FAO economist Jonathan Pound explains what a robust food supply means.
At the global level, so aggregating the production of all countries in the world, there was a small increase in global cereal production this year. There was a 1.1% increase in 2016 compared to the previous year in 2015. So it implies that we have a good supply situation.
Besides strong cereal production gains worldwide, the FAO reports a record recovery for larger cereal crops in Asia, Europe, and Central America. Despite strong harvests in much of the world, famine has been declared in parts of South Sudan and looms in Somalia, Nigeria, and Yemen. All are affected by ongoing conflict.
Conflict both affects the imports of food into the country, but also within the country as well to distribute the food. But then you also have the impact on the agricultural system directly, where farmers aren't able to access their farmland in some cases, and they aren't able to access inputs as well. And so this limits the productive capacity of farming households.
About 100,000 people in South Sudan face famine in Leer and Mayendit counties in Unity State. But the FAO report warns of an elevated risk of famine in two nearby counties as well. But there are problems countrywide. Nearly 5 million people in South Sudan are at risk. That number is expected to jump by 500,000 at the peak of the lean season in July.
And then after that, we expect the harvest of the good crops to be available, and that should lead to some improvements in the food security status.
In Somalia, the number of people who are classified as severely food insecure has more than doubled in the past 6 months to nearly 3 million people. Pound says Somalia has been the victim of conflict, insecurity, and drought.
There have been three consecutive poor rainy seasons, so that's compounded the impact of the conflict.
The FAO says more than 8 million people face acute food insecurity in northern Nigeria. That's despite an above-average cereal harvest in the country. The Boko Haram insurgency and the depreciation of the Naira are to blame.
It's contributed to pushing up prices, impinging on food access for some of the population. Despite having a good harvest, there's likely to be an increase in the number of people who are food insecure as well.
And in Yemen, the FAO reports 17 million people, two-thirds of the population, are food insecure. About half of those need emergency aid as the war there goes on. Conflicts and violence could also worsen food insecurity in Burundi, Central African Republic, the DRC, Afghanistan, Iraq, Myanmar, and Syria. The report says 37 countries require outside food assistance. 28 of them are in Africa. Much of that is due, it says, to the lingering effects of the El Nino weather event, namely drought. Pound says those figures are holding fairly steady.
The Global Information Early Warning System within FAO, we track and monitor these countries on a quarterly basis. I mean, the numbers more or less remain at this level. A few countries have come in and a few countries have come out over the past years.
Improvements are expected in southern Africa this year as countries recover from drought. South Africa is expected to have a bumper maize crop, but Zimbabwe, Mozambique, Zambia, and Malawi are among the countries battling an invasion of the fall armyworm. The Food and Agriculture Organization will release its next crop prospects and food situation report in June. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
The World Health Organization is appealing for $10 million as part of an effort to bring drought relief to Somalia. Drought has led to a food emergency there, but also to the spread of cholera, diarrhea, and measles. Dr. Michael Tyrine is the WHO's Regional Emergency Director for the Eastern Mediterranean. VOA's William Eagle asked him about the impact of the drought on Somalia.
There is a severe drought in the whole of Africa, but the impact on a country so fragile like Somalia is much more than other countries. South Sudan, Somalia are particularly at risk of having a dramatic impact of that climatic event.
Is this because in both countries you have just cited that there's a lack, for example, of government services, which makes the situation more precarious?
Yeah, exactly. So we have in other countries an institutional development and maturity that is higher than others. In Somalia, it's certainly no country for strong government-led services. It's a country that is fragmented in different geographical areas, that is also claiming different militancies, and where the access is certainly not homogeneous throughout the country. So when we talk about Somalia, we cannot just say that Somalia. It's a myriad of geographical variation, access, you know, unequal access in areas, different levels of development. It's overall a country where the health system has literally collapsed. And that makes the situation totally depending on external aid.
In terms of external aid, food, and humanitarian care, how are you able to get in there if the situation is so bad with no service delivery? Are you using largely convoys and aircraft? How are you delivering the aid to these different areas of Somalia?
For the moment, convoys are operating. We have people on the ground, but there are partners that have a different operational coverage than we do. We are present in a few places of Somalia. We're present in Mogadishu. We have a very high number of, as we call, sentinel surveillance, which are places where you have some people able to detect any impending outbreaks, disease, or high mortality, or anything that would signal rapid deterioration of the population health. So we have a presence. We can access many places of Somalia. We can deliver supply. We're not in a situation where we have to do airdropping necessarily, but still, access is unequal, insecure in many places, and we compose with that. And WHO is approaching the drought in a comprehensive manner, looking at public health, provision of essential drugs and medicine, and of course, deploying Center for Therapeutic Feeding, because we need to restore at least the nutritional status on all those children.
The population is suffering in Somalia from some diseases. Some are waterborne, such as cholera and diarrhea, and also the measles. What is the link between the drought and the spread of these illnesses?
The drought first fragilized completely any human being in its immune system. So the drought and the food insecurity it induces and the nutritional status that creates among especially children and mothers makes this population very receptive to any illness. So those diseases are endemic there. We have measles endemicity in Somalia, like in many, many parts of the world. But if you combine already full immunization coverage, you know, the children over there are not well immunized at the baseline. And you put a severe drought, which aggravates the nutritional status of those children. Therefore, the immune defense system is also very weakened. They don't have the robustness to fight themselves against the diseases. Then you have a very, very propitious terrain for massive outbreaks. Also, there's water out of very extremely poor quality, very contaminated, and then people keep reinfecting themselves.
That was Dr. Michelle Tyreen, head of the WHO's Regional Emergency Director for the Eastern Mediterranean. He spoke with VOA's William Eagle. Also, the International Organization for Migration is appealing for more than $24.5 million to help more than 1 million people affected by drought in Somalia. Drought is hurting Eastern Africa's parks and game reserves and the creatures that reside in them. The Kenya Wildlife Service says dozens of animals have already died because of the lack of water. Mohamed Yusuf has more from Nairobi.
Kenyan wildlife officials say animals at reserves in the north of the country and the coast region faced starvation after low rainfall at the end of last year. Last month, the government declared the drought a national disaster. Kenya Wildlife Service spokesman Paul Gatitu says lack of water and grazing land has pushed some animals into human settlements, increasing the risk of human-wildlife conflict.
We've had impact on wildlife, particularly the outside, not in the protected areas. Ijara was the first area that we noticed, and next to Boni Forest were some dams, and which now dried up, and that forced a number of animals to now go seeking for water and struggling to access water. And we lost five buffaloes who are stuck in the mud in that place.
The Wildlife Agency says it has lost 15 hippos in Lake Kenyatta, Lamu County. Kahindi Lekahaile of the African Network for Animal Welfare blames a lack of preparation for the suffering and deaths of animals.
What we are seeing is that the effects of drought are being made worse by ignorance, poverty and desperation by ignored people who would have actually supported the wildlife as the wildlife actually moves out to look for pastures and water. So a drought will always be with us. You know, it's how we manage drought. Now, wildlife is suffering as a result of us not preparing for drought and us not actually managing our resources properly.
The wild animals attract millions of dollars in tourist revenue every year. Tourism is a leading foreign exchange earner for Kenya after agriculture. The industry employs more than 200,000 people. Gatitu of the Kenya Wildlife Service says his agency is digging more wells and supplying water to the animals.
We work together with organizations like Big Life, and we provide water to the schools so the communities get water away from the field where they would have otherwise now been encountering wildlife. In places like Lamu, we've actually supplied water to those dams.
Wildlife in Kenya already face constant threats from poachers and communities living around the conservation areas. The Department of Resource Surveys and Remote Sensing says Kenya has lost 68% of its wildlife in the last four decades. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
18 past the hour, you were listening to African News Tonight on The Voice of America. The international child advocacy organization Save the Children says children as old as 15 are flooding into preschool facilities in northeast Nigeria. It's part of a desperate move to get an education after more than 7 years of conflict and insurgent attacks by Boko Haram. An estimated 1,200 schools have been damaged or destroyed, while at least 611 teachers have been reported murdered and a further 19,000 displaced. They say the situation is symptomatic of an education crisis across the Lake Chad region. The area includes Nigeria, Niger, Cameroon, and Chad, now home to a quarter of the world's estimated 59 million out-of-school children. Katharina Bu is a senior advocacy advisor for Save the Children. She has just returned from northeast Nigeria and spoke with reporter Kim Lewis about the education crisis there and about what is needed to ensure children get access to quality education.
Talking about education in northeast Nigeria, it is important to look at how the situation also was before the crisis. Actually, this area around the Lake Chad was pretty much already experiencing an education crisis prior to the ongoing conflict. Looking at numbers, which we have to be careful about because data is very poor, but estimates show that across the four countries currently suffering from this particular conflict, they were already in an education crisis with a total of 14 million children out of school prior to the crisis. That is actually 25% or one-fourth of all children out of school globally. And what we've seen is that conflict, which has lasted now for almost 8 years, have exacerbated the barriers for children to attend school and worsened what I would call the world's largest education crisis. Schools have been targeted, teachers have been killed, and more than 1,000 schools have been attacked, many of them destroyed, and approximately 19,000 teachers have fled.
So then where does one start in terms of trying to repair the problem and make it so that children can get an education? Because I know it is a huge task to take on, but where do you start?
It's a very good question. I would start on a positive note. What we've seen is that actually the crisis and how it has affected education in particular have actually created a momentum right now. We see, especially in Maiduguri, which is the largest city in Borno State, the most affected state in Northeast Nigeria, we see that because education has been targeted in particular, children and parents are actually more concerned now than before about giving their children education. At least we have some engagement from the community and from parents and children to actually get children into school. So that is very, very good. And of course, then what is needed is to start step by step to build a sustainable school system that can actually absorb all of the out-of-school children. That will take time, but it's what is needed. At the same time, we see that many children have not been at school at all or have lost education due to the conflict. For them, it's important that we get accelerated learning programs to make sure that we can get them quickly into the education system, especially then targeting youth as well.
Also, young girls particularly have a hard time in getting education. Will there be a separate focus on them or more emphasis on girls getting education?
Definitely. This is very important for Save the Children globally and in this context. What we see is that if you are a girl in Nigeria and in these countries, you are left behind in many, many ways, and also when it comes to education. While the average Nigerian expects to receive 9 years of schooling, that figure drops to just 2 years for girls in the Northeast. And actually, we have estimates that show that half of 9 to 12-year-olds in Northeast Nigeria have never been to school, and many of these are girls. And a barrier for these girls is early marriage. We see that many of the girls in this region are married off at a very early age. This is a key priority for Save the Children and something that we definitely want to work with local partners, with the local government, and with communities themselves.
You have mentioned that you all did some research and you're going to be putting out that information. What research did you recently do?
Well, we had a research team visiting Maiduguri recently to look at the barriers for children, and we just have some preliminary results so far, but it's quite clear that what comes out from that research is that the insurgency itself has exacerbated the ongoing education crisis, and particularly highlighting first and foremost the food and hunger crisis, especially how food is a key barrier for children not attending school. A child who is hungry will not have the power or the capacity to go to school. So this is something we want to engage more in and need to focus more on as a humanitarian community, how we can see and make sure that we have integrated programming which links education to, for example, school feeding programs. So that is one of the outcomes of a report that we're currently working on.
Katerina Bu is a senior advocacy advisor for the Save the Children. She spoke with reporter Kim Lewis from Oslo, Norway. In Libya, the fragile UN-backed Government of National Accord, the GNA, has struggled since 2015 to impose its authority. It's particularly weak in the east, where military strongman General Khalifa Haftar is aligned with a rival government that controls key oil export terminals. Faiz al-Sarj, the head of the GNA, is visiting Moscow. He's seeking a Russian mediation that could help bring about a political solution to end the conflict. Rayanon Smith is managing editor of Libya Analysis. She spoke to VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawi about going to Moscow and not Washington to find a political solution.
Well, I think this shows that Russia is trying to have an increasingly dominant role within Libya, both in political and economic terms. So the fact that Russia has invited Sarraj and he is going to Russia shows that they are almost trying to take over the role of the UN and some of the Western nations who have had the most important role in trying to bring about a political agreement between Libya's competing factions.
Could Moscow pressure General Khalifa Haftar, commander of the Libyan National Army, to negotiate political deal with Sarraj instead of his military approach?
This is what Sarraj and the government of National Accord in Tripoli are hoping for. So Sarraj and Haftar were meant to have a meeting in Cairo a couple of weeks ago. However, Haftar pulled out of this meeting and he is still taking a very anti-negotiation approach. However, because Russia is seen to be supporting Haftar, the GNA are hoping that they can persuade Russia to kind of force Haftar to take part in these negotiations. However, it is not really clear whether Russia does have that power. They are certainly influential and have some clout in the eastern camp. However, Haftar is his own man and he's quite a strong personality, so it may be that Russia doesn't actually have the ability to force Haftar to take part in these negotiations.
Why do you think Sarraj resorted to Moscow and not to Washington?
Russia, in the last few months, has been very visible on the ground in Libya. They've been engaging in Libya, not just with Haftar, but also with members of the GNA and with Sarraj. There's been a recent deal between a Russian oil company and Libya's National Oil Corporation in the last 2 weeks. So there's really a visible presence of Russia. Russia are trying to get things done in Libya, or that's the impression they're giving. Whereas with the US administration, we're still pretty clueless about what the Trump administration wants to do in Libya and what his approach is going to be. And therefore, in the absence of a clear US policy or clear US engagement on Libya, different Libyan factions are increasingly turning to Russia to play this role.
What's your assessment of prospects for ending the civil war in Libya?
Currently, what is on the table, which is a political agreement brokered by Egypt, Algeria and Tunisia, the aim of which is to bring together delegations of the competing factions to try and agree amendments to the Libyan political agreement. I think that is the most promising route to try and find some sort of power-sharing agreement and a way out of a civil war and conflict. However, that does depend on getting all of the parties together and in one place, which so far hasn't happened, and a key figure and element in that is Haftar and what he decides to do. If he continues to take a militaristic approach, then I think that will only escalate the conflict, unfortunately. So a lot does ride on whether it's Russia or other regional powers being able to persuade Haftar to enter these negotiations and try to come to a meaningful power-sharing agreement.
Rhiannon Smith is managing editor of Libya Analysis. She spoke to VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawi. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC. For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the sunny side of sports. And thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, music lovers. Habari! This is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in this Sunday and quench your thirst for awesome African music. I have fresh news and interviews from my recent trip to Zanzibar and Nairobi. Tums, baby. I've got great classics from Cameroon and Nigeria, listener requests, and new releases. So tune in to VOA Africa's FM station this Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC. Bon appétit!